All right, Hebrews 9 this evening. Hebrews chapter 9. We're going to get to, tell you what, let's do this. We'll get to Hebrews 9 just a little bit. Turn to Leviticus 16. Hebrews 9 and 10, a lot of what's in here builds on the foundational concepts from the Old Testament, specifically here, God's revelation about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus chapter 16. Most Christians, when you say, turn to Leviticus, they just say, oh, okay, you just lost me. Wake me up when we're out of Leviticus, you know. But it's really important to understanding what's going on here in Hebrews 9 and 10 to have the foundation, because you can just read what's going on in 9 and 10, and if we don't have the old thing to compare it to, we really don't appreciate it. If you were to just put on glasses, wake up, okay, here's everything that's great. But when you see what you used to see before glasses, I'm talking about people who have glasses now. If not, then this doesn't really, you won't appreciate this illustration. But if you really needed glasses, maybe your eyes got worse and worse and worse and worse, and you don't really notice them getting worse and worse and worse until there's some moment that you're in the back row and you're supposed to read the whiteboard, and the professor's writing too small. And the only reason he's writing too small is because your eyes are bad now. This was me and in high school. I was 16 when I had to get glasses. And so through college and so forth, I needed them if I was going to see what was written on the board. And you don't really notice day by day, my vision is about 3% worse than it was last month. You don't notice a small incremental change. But then when you put on, you're sitting there in the chair and they bring that thing down that's got all the bells and whistles, and they click, 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 and they're like, click, and you're like, whoa, that could be me? And they make it, and you put on your glasses. And the first day you put on your glasses, you walk around, and you're looking at everything like, wow, trees and birds. And I mean, I could see the sun before, but now it's so much clearer. I feel like I could just stare at the sun all day. Or I could see the craters on the moon. I never knew there were craters on the moon. Things like this. When you see both, you really appreciate the better. And so many people, they don't spend time in the Old Testament to see what used to be there. So what Jesus has, it's all they've ever heard, all they've ever known. They don't really appreciate it. And by the way, I think the people who appreciated it the most were the people during the days of Jesus, when the sacrificial system is going on. And this is their life, and they live it, and they live it, and live it. And then Jesus comes and says, I have something so much better. All that is done. What I'm allowed to do on the cross is once and for all. You know, the apostles, they lived under both, and they could fully appreciate. So many people obviously didn't live under both. Some people, now people can be brought up under false religion, and that's a great contrast to the truth. Amen? That they can see works, and they can see effort and vanity, and then all of a sudden the truth comes. And when they put them up side by side, when you hold anything up next to Jesus, who he is and what he's done, you immediately appreciate Jesus more than if you just look at him by himself. And so that's what we're going to start with tonight. We're going to start with, depressing and discouraging things, because we're not under them. But we're going to start by looking at the picture and some important things that we need to have in the back of our minds, in our mindset as we read through, as we get to Hebrews 9. So look at Leviticus chapter 16. And we're not going to read all this. We'll read a few verses. We'll read verses 1 through 3. The occasion here, why was this written when it was written in Leviticus 16? What was going on in the nation of Israel that God decided at this moment? Because he could have revealed it earlier. He could have revealed this at the Mount in Exodus when the Ten Commandments were given. But he waited until some other things happened before he gave the Day of Atonement. One thing, by the way, that's in the background is that, we'll see this as we read Leviticus 16, is that two of Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, have just recently died. Why did they die? Because they took on themselves to do something brand new. We've got a really neat idea. "Hey, Mom, watch this." You know, some kind of famous last words. And they decided they were going to offer strange fire, this new incense or something, taken in before the Lord, which God did not call them to do. They had something different, some new idea. "We got a better idea than God," and they died right on the spot for it. Wow. And this obviously got Aaron's attention. God, this is interesting. God told Aaron, "You're not allowed to mourn for them. Your two sons just died. You're not allowed to mourn publicly for them because I have judged them, and you are going to back up my decision on this by not mourning them publicly." And so some people believe that before Nadab and Abihu did what they did, this is a little bit of an argument from silence, but some people believe that going into the Holy of Holies once a year, only by the high priest, only with blood, some people believe that that was different before Nadab and Abihu did what they did. So look at Leviticus 16, verse 1. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered before the Lord and died. And the Lord said unto Moses, Speak unto Aaron thy brother, that he come not at all times into the holy place within the veil before the mercy seat, which is upon the ark, that he die not. For I will appear in the cloud upon the mercy seat. Thus shall Aaron come into the holy place with a young bullock for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering." So it's interesting that it says, after they died, God says, "I'm going to do something new to protect everyone else." Nadab and Abihu, they had a good idea. They were not the high priests. Under this, they wouldn't have been allowed in there anyway. And so now maybe God, to protect other priests and other people, now maybe he is restricting access. And we looked at the restriction of access as awful. "Oh no, we want to go in." But God, I think, did it as a favor to them, to spare their lives from doing it the wrong way and dying. And so he sets up the requirements and the details of the Day of Atonement after. So maybe that's one of the reasons that God does it here. Another reason, and that was, in chapter 10, Leviticus 10, when that happened. In Leviticus 11 through 15, God, we're not going to read, but God gives a lot of details. He gives an explanation of how people could become unclean. And there were so many ways that people could become unclean that you could be unclean and not even know it. You could accidentally just become unclean. And so it explains a lot of the details. And so God here is going to show the solemnity, the serious business of the Day of Atonement, so that people wouldn't come in unclean in all these various ways and now do the Day of Atonement unclean. So you had to be cleansed first. And so there's a lot of details about how to cleanse people, how to cleanse the nation. So let's look at another verse. Look at a key purpose of the Day of Atonement. What was the Day of Atonement all about? And the key purpose was cleansing, as we said, the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, or the holy place itself was cleansed by what went on here. Look at Leviticus 16 and verse 16. It says, "And he shall make an atonement for the holy place." Interesting. You don't usually think about it that way. Like, hey, before we do anything, we need to make an atonement for the holy place. What has the holy place done? Well, the holy place didn't do anything, but people have done things to the holy place. That their sin, there's kind of this picture potentially, that the sin of the nation has spilled out, has spilled over and defiled the temple. Because the people are living among the temple. They're walking around it. And they have made unclean that holy place. So one thing that has to happen is they have to cleanse the holy place. And it says, because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions and all their sins, and so shall he do for the tabernacle of the congregation that remaineth among them in the midst of their uncleanness. Now, they didn't literally get out a power washer. They didn't literally use water and wash the tabernacle, but by blood they cleansed the tabernacle in the sight of God. So this is a ceremonial cleanness. This is God saying, "I now accept whatever's going to go on." If they just did the Day of Atonement without this, The whole nation would not have their sins atoned for. It had to start with the holy place being cleansed, and then the priest had to be cleansed, and then the combination of a clean holy place and a clean priest would do something that could clean the people. There is a lot of details. God would not just say, okay, you're good, go on. You had to dot your I's and cross your T's, and that's what this chapter is all about. Look at also verse 19, Leviticus 16, 19. Same idea. It says, "And he shall sprinkle of the blood upon it with his finger seven times and cleanse it," the holy place, "and hallow it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel." Their sin, the Bible says in other places, defiled the land. And here it says that their sin is defiling the holy place. God cannot, and so nothing literal is happening here, but God's trying to give Israel a picture that he cannot live among sin. God is lifting up himself and showing that he is holy. And if you're going to come and worship me in my holy place, we have to cleanse it of sin first, because God will not be there. What would happen if they do? Well, God's presence just wouldn't be there. There was a cloud that would abide over the tabernacle and a pillar of fire that would abide over it to show Israel that God is there. But if you neglect God's ways, do it your own way, God says, "I'll take it up. I'll leave and you'll be on your own." Imagine wandering around in the wilderness, in the desert, all by yourself without God's direction and God's blessing. That was a very real possibility. So to keep that from happening, the Day of Atonement had to happen so that God could continue to live among his people. And so we look at the ritual is explained, and we're not going to read all verses 6 through 10, but here are four things that would happen, explained in verses 6 through 10, on the Day of Atonement. One is that Aaron would offer a bull as a sacrifice for himself and for the priest. Had to start there. He can't offer for the people until he offers for himself. Second thing that would happen is that lots were cast. There were two goats, and one goat gets the short straw. of the two goats, lots were cast to see which of them was killed and which of them was sent away into the wilderness. And then the third thing that happened is, as a result of that, one of the goats is sacrificed. And then the second goat was sent, it's often called the scapegoat. The second goat is sent away into the wilderness. What they would do is they'd gather around, and the priests would put their hands on the head of that goat, symbolizing that sin was being transferred to the goat. And then they would send away the goat. They would, quote unquote, send away their sin. And it's a beautiful, that's one of the greatest pictures in the Bible of forgiveness, of God's forgiveness of us, of the forgiveness that we should offer other people, is that you take that sin and you send it away. And you would never go, who knows where that goat went? You didn't track it. They didn't put a tracker. This is before GPS trackers. I don't know what they would try to do nowadays. But they purposely would lose the goat. A fit man, it says, would take it far out into the wilderness. And then he would let it go, and then he would just come back, and nobody's ever looking for that goat. You don't want to go looking for your sin anymore, and God's not going to call it up to remembrance. So that's to me, is a great, whenever I visualize that, it's a great picture of what I should be doing when other people wrong me. You send it away once, and you don't keep count. Hey, that's the fifth time you've done that. Well, it should be the first time. I should start over because I shouldn't keep track. I shouldn't remember. And the word remember means to bring it back up and act on it. And so God says, "Their sins and iniquities will I remember no more." It's pictured on the Day of Atonement when they would send away this goat. And so then, again, we won't read this for sake of time, but verses 11 through 28 give the details of this, of the ritual and of the four steps that we just mentioned. When the blood was sacrificed, Aaron was to take his blood and a censer of coals into the Holy of Holies to cover the mercy seat. Smoke would come off of that censer and, so to speak, surround him and, so to speak, protect him or shield him from God's glory. The lots, once it said that the lots, once they were determined, were literally placed on the heads of the goats so that they wouldn't be confused. You know, okay, you get the short straw, you get the long straw. Okay, now let's do some things. And let's see, which one was it? I remember this one was something. He either got the short or the long. So it's often said that they would literally take these lots. Some people think they're kind of like dice or something. People have different ideas. And they would place them on their heads so that they would remember. Not get them confused. My dad, when he had, several years ago, he had his eye out. He had his eye removed, surgery. He was watching a documentary, I think it was on 2020, about all these wrong side operations. It said there were 20,000 wrong side operations per year in the United States, where you'd go in to get an arm taken off and they took the wrong arm, or you'd go to get a foot. 20,000 wrong amputations every year in the United States. The bulk of those were in Florida, unfortunately. Anyway, so it recommended that you write on your body, you know, before you go in, you like draw arrows on your body or asterisks, you know, this is what you're supposed to. So he did. He took an arrow and he drew it above his eye. And pointed right to it. And then he said he's lying there and he's thinking, I wonder if the doctor remember what the arrow's for, you know. Is this the one I take or is this the one I leave? So anyway, they would try to make sure that they had the right goat, so they would put the lots right there on their heads. And then after sacrificing the first goat, they would lay their hands on the second goat, identifying it with the sins of the people and send it away. Real fast, I want to look at the word for scapegoat is the Hebrew word Azazel. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but some people, there's different ideas about what the meaning of Azazel is. Some people, and I believe wrongly, say that this name represented a demon. That here's kind of the idea that they would, maybe even Satan himself, that we're saying that this scapegoat is sinful. We're going to, and this name means it's a demon. We're going to send this away. The name Azazel, for sake of time, we're not going to turn there tonight, but the name Azazel is equated with a demon in one of the extra biblical, the book of Enoch. A couple of verses that it uses the name Azazel and equates it with a demon. What they believed in was this parallelism idea. One goat's for the Lord, one goat's for the devil. And so they would separate it out that way. And then the goat was to go to an uninhabited land. And some believed that back then that the deserts were where the demons would live. And so you're going to send this goat out to the realm of the demons, and this goat represented the demon. But instead, I think here's some reasons why I disagree with that. One, they were in the desert, but just because they were in the desert, just because you see demons in the desert, you do see this in the New Testament, just because there were demons that may have been in the desert doesn't mean that they owned it and that was the place of that was, you know, equated with them necessarily. Also, after the Day of Atonement, it's commanded in another place that they are not to offer sacrifices to devils and demons. That's kind of what this would be. If we're taking this scapegoat, we're calling it a demon, they're interacting with devils is what they would be doing. When you two look at them together they are the sin offering. Both the first goat and the scapegoat, they are the sin offering. And so God would not, they together are to sacrifice to God. We're not sacrificing to devils. This may be a small point. You may have never even given this a thought, but it's out there. And we're going to talk later on this evening, potentially, if we get there, about, you know, the concept that Jesus offers his blood as payment to the devil. And we'll talk about that a little bit. So anyway, I believe that instead that the name Azazel is just an abstract noun that signifies a complete removal. This sin, we're going to take it, the word scapegoat is just a removal of sin, and it's a good picture of what's happening on the Day of Atonement. Okay, let's get to Hebrews chapter 9. That's a snapshot of what happens. That's what Hebrews 9 is built on. They don't explain it in Hebrews because it was written to Hebrews, and they were aware of that. But sometimes that falls away from modern Christianity is a good understanding. So look at Hebrews 9. Let's start by reading verses 1 through 5. Hebrews 9, 1 through 5. What we see here is a description of the tabernacle that Jesus, or that in the Old Testament tabernacle, that was in the sacrificial system. It says, "Then verily, the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle made, the first..." We've got a first tabernacle, and then we're going to have a true tabernacle, or a heavenly tabernacle. "For there was a tabernacle made, the first, wherein was the candlestick..." And the first also is talking about, you've got the holy place and the holy of holies, different sections in it. "The first wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant. And over it, the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly." So let's real fast talk about some of these details that are mentioned here. You have the candlestick mentioned. And by the way, some people debate about some of the meanings here and pictures that are being given. There are different ideas for the candlestick. An idea that I like is that the candlestick is a representation of Israel's responsibility to be a light to others, to be a light to the Gentiles, which they never accomplished well. Never. Because they dropped the ball, Jesus had to do it a different way. He has now chosen the church to do that. But the Messiah, remember, the Messiah was always to be a light to the Gentiles. The book of Isaiah says that. Israel never wanted that mantle. Why were they chosen? Because they were better? No, they were the least. They were sinful. From the day that God met them, they were sinful. They were not chosen because they were any better. They were chosen because God loved them. He just decided he could have chosen anyone. But he chose them because he wanted them to be a light. And then we've talked about this before. They ran the exact wrong direction. They said, "Hey, we're better than everyone because God chose us." That was never the intent. They were supposed to be a light to others. And the candlestick maybe is a good picture of that. Jesus said he was the light of the world. Next thing mentioned is the table and the showbread. There were 12 loaves of bread on that table representing the 12 tribes of Israel. It mentions the second veil in verse 3 that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place. This veil was made of blue, purple, and scarlet thread. It was very thick. It was as thick as a man's hand. It doesn't say how much it weighed, but it had to be quite a heavy cloth. It was very thick, and it was adorned with figures of the cherubim on it. Next thing it also mentions is the holiest of all. It was about a 15 by 15 room. So kind of I guess that's a little bit bigger than your average second, third bedroom in a house. What are they, like 12 or 13 by 13, something like that. So it's kind of like a bedroom size, 15 by 15, only you would not go and sleep in there. Overstay your welcome, and you would wake up dead. I guess you wouldn't wake up. Anyway, it also mentions the golden censer, there's an altar there with coals. And so this, it says it's residing in the Holy of Holies. By the way, this is a little small point. The Old Testament mentions that it's in the holy place. Here it says it's in the Holy of Holies. Why does it say that? Well, it would be taken in there. The altar is there, but then you take it in. Maybe it's talking about that's where it would serve its function. The function of it is in the Holy of Holies, so don't think that there's a discrepancy there. And then it gets to the Ark of the Covenant. It says there's three things inside the Ark of the Covenant. There's the pot of manna. Why would they put pot of manna in there? In case God's hungry? Is that what that's about? No. That's pagan ideas or giving God food. They put the pot of manna in there to remind them of God's faithfulness in providing for them in the desert. Whenever that was... by the way, I don't know how often they'd lift high priest would lift the lid and look in, but it was just in there as a kind of a memorial. So that Israel would know, quote unquote, it's written down. They'd know that it's in there. Never forget that God provided for us. He'll take care of our needs there. He will always take care of our needs. Also, was Aaron's rod that budded. What was that about? This is about recognizing God's authority that He has set up. There was a time that the sons of Korah said, "Hey, you and Moses, you and Aaron, you take too much on you. You guys think you're all that. You know, we're all that too. We're just as wonderful as you are. You think you're better than us?" And they disrespected his authority. And God says, "Okay, everybody bring your rod and put it in here. And then in the morning, we'll find out." In the next morning, Aaron's rod had eaten all the other rods. No, I'm just kidding. That's not what happened. But it says that all the other rods are normal. And God did a miracle with Aaron's rod. He caused it to bloom, and there were buds and blossoms and almonds. You never see that all happen one night on anything. But this stick that's not even growing out of the earth, it's just a stick now, it did all of that in one night. And God did that to show, I choose Aaron's rod. I recognize his authority as the priest because I instituted him. As a reminder of that, that rebuking of other people trying to usurp authority, that was to be put into the... Now, I don't know if they do that. Was Aaron's rod smaller? Ark of the Covenant's pretty small. Did they cut it up and put it in there? It doesn't give the details, but they would, maybe the section of it that bloomed, they would put in there. By the way, did it stay bloomed and blossomed for decades and hundreds of years? I don't know. Presumably, it sounds like, but anyway, they put in the rod there that happened. And then the third thing in there is the tables of the covenant, the Ten Commandments that God wrote on and gave to Moses on Mount Sinai as a perpetual reminder that Israel is under the law, that they're responsible to keep the law. And then it mentions also, the last thing it mentions is that there are cherubim that are overshadowing the mercy seat. People often say that cherubim are the highest ranking angels, angelic beings, and they're associated often with the glory of God. They lift up God and glorify Him. They're mentioned in Genesis 3, guarding the entrance to Eden. They're found on the walls in both Solomon's and Ezekiel's temples. And so to give glory, lift up God. Okay, so those are some of the details. Let's go on and look at verses 6 through 10 and look at not just the tabernacle, but a description of the service that was going on in the tabernacle. Verse 6, Hebrews 9, 6 says, "Now when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone, once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people." All this that is saying here is going to be a great contrast with Jesus. So that's the way they used to do it there. Verse 8, "The Holy Ghost, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing." That's an interesting point, an important point mentioned here, that we could never have the access. This is one proof of the nail in the coffin of Judaism. We could never have access to God directly like we do now until the sacrificial system is done. You could never have both coexisting at the same time. As long as there is a tabernacle where God says, "My presence is here," and it's restricted, you cannot have that and people having direct access to God. He had to end the first before he could start the second. So, and by the way, this whole concept here is the pinnacle of the whole argument of why they can't go back to the Judaistic system. Because what's there is dead. God has shifted. It's not he didn't shift salvation, it's always by grace through faith. But God has shifted the way to access. It's no longer through the sacrificial system. It's no longer in that building. God fills the heavens and we go directly to Him. So why should anyone ever go back to Judaism when this is where the reality of God is, and that now is just a sham? That now they're just playing, they're not even playing church, it's not church, but they're playing religion. They're playing get to know God, and He's not there anymore. Let's look at verses 9 and 10, and we'll talk about this section. "Which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience." which stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. And that is not a reference to Martin Luther, by the way. Talking about Jesus. So let's look at some of the descriptions of the service. First of all, let's see, there are seven things we'll mention here. Number one is only the high priest had access. Nobody else. Didn't matter how holy you were. Didn't matter how spiritual, how much you knew God. David was a great man. Could not have access. Anyone else that was a lower priest couldn't have access. One man, and the high priest, only the high priest could have access. By the way, there sometimes this was on a rotational basis. The way that God originally set it up is not the way that it continued. During the days, when you get to the days of Jesus, Zechariah, he does this, he performs this, and at that time, they would do it one time. You could do this once ever, and you're done. You couldn't do it twice. It was looked on to be such a high and special thing that you were, one day, you could be chosen out of the millions of Israelites. One person could do that. And you were chosen once, and then that was it. They wanted to kind of spread it around a little bit. And they would cast lots at that point to determine who would do that. And sometimes you wait your whole life and never get to do that. So, only the high priest, number two, he could only go once a year. He couldn't just say, oh, there was one thing yesterday I meant to say to God. You have to do it next year. You could only go in once a year. Number three, he would have to use something outside of himself. He would have to bring the blood from another life, the blood of an animal, the blood of a goat. It had to be something else. The high priest could not bring something of himself. He didn't have anything to offer God. He would have to bring, this is a great contrast with Jesus. The high priest had to bring something from outside of himself. Number four is that he had to first offer for himself. He didn't just walk in and pray for the people. First, he had to cleanse himself. Another great contrast from Jesus. Number five is that there was not direct access like we have. By the way, let's talk about why our access to Jesus is better. A couple of details that are mentioned here. Number one is that our access is permanent. I hope that you not only know, but that you practice that you have permanent access to God. You never do something as a Christian and now you're locked out forever. You're locked out of the throne room of God. You can come back. Now you have to come back, and the first thing you have to do is ask for forgiveness if you've strayed. But you are welcomed back. You have permanent, that it goes all the way through the end of your life and then unbroken into heaven for eternity. And by the way, look at a great verse here, Romans chapter 5 and verses 1 and 2, Romans 5, that we have great permanent access because of Jesus to God. Romans 5, 1, it says, therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. We have access. And by the way, there, that phrase that we have, it's in the perfect tense, indicating, and here we're talking about what Jesus, the phrase have access, it's in the perfect tense that indicates that what was secured for us as justified Christians, it happened in the past. So we have access because of what previously happened. The perfect tense in Greek means it happened in the past with continuing results into the present. And something in the perfect tense, it doesn't continue for a while and end. It means it was done once and it continues. And so we have a permanent access. Another idea is that another reason that our access is better is because we are introduced by Jesus himself to God's presence. Before, the high priest would come in and do some things, but we have Jesus himself introducing us. There was a story that, a true story that happened during the Civil War, that a Confederate soldier was let go because he was disabled. He was kind of discharged. And he wanted to get his brother out also because his mother desired that. You know, you got hurt. I don't want to lose your brother. And he had a desire. So where does he go? He tried to go to the White House and he tried to have an audience with President Lincoln. But no one would allow him to go through. And the story goes that he's sitting outside and President Lincoln's son, Tad, sees him crying and asks him what his problem is and what's wrong. And he tells his story. And Tad takes him by the hand and takes him past the security. They'll let Tad through, but they wouldn't let him through. And so Tad brings him in, and he has an audience with the president himself. And it's pictures that Jesus, we pray in Jesus' name, because we don't have an audience with God except Jesus paved the way. And he takes our hand. He's that great mediator, that go-between. He can touch us, he can touch God, and he can bring us together. And so we have direct access that's permanent. It's permanent, and it's also direct because Jesus introduces us, and so we can deal with God directly. We don't need another mediator, another priest beyond Jesus. We also see here there's kind of a vision of God that we can imagine, that we are in His presence. You know, when you pray, we do this. We come, and by the way, we often are lax, aren't we? Maybe you're not. Sometimes I can be lax. You know, we're praying, we can slouch, we can fall asleep, we get comfortable as we come into God's presence. When you see, we're going to turn and look at examples tonight, but we've done this in the past. When you see in the Bible that people come into God's presence, well, one says that when Aaron would do that, he's probably scared to death, shaking. You know, my two sons died when they came in here the wrong way. I hope I don't die. And generation by generation, the priests were kind of, okay, I'm going to take this and this, but I may also bring my rabbit's foot for good luck, just in case, you know. I don't know. They probably didn't bring a rabbit's foot. But they were scared. And when you see people, you see great men in the Bible like Isaiah and Daniel and John. These are people who know God. When they meet with God, they don't just haphazardly linger. They are struck dumb by the awesome presence of God. And sometimes we can cheapen by saying, oh yeah, why don't you say a prayer for me? You know, hey, yeah, we'll say you a little prayer. And not think we are going to go into the presence of God where people were scared to death to go and people could die in the past. But now we have access and it's a great privilege. But don't let a great privilege cause you to neglect the awesome responsibility, the awesome wonder of being in God's presence. Whenever you by yourself close your eyes and pray, you go literally or spiritually, you go into the presence of God. That's awesome. And you have access to the power of the universe. Whatever your problem is, God can snap his fingers and it's all done. And we lose sight of that. We lose sight of the privilege that we have to have that access. Talks about the last couple things we'll mention tonight. The problem of perfection. In verse 9, it mentions that look at it. Hebrews 9:9, it says, which was that could not, all of that offering gifts and sacrifices, it could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. So the idea of perfection, the word perfect there, and I think we've mentioned this earlier in the book of Hebrews, but it has to do with an inward fitness to approach God. It doesn't mean that you're literally perfect or that you're totally complete, but it means that God makes you fit to be able to come into His presence. The Old Testament sacrifices could never do that. They could never make Him perfect as pertaining to the conscience. Interesting, that idea of the conscience. The word conscience is used 5 times in Hebrews, and 4 of these are going to be right here in chapters 9 and 10. And it, what's pictured here is what the animal sacrifices could not do, making us inwardly fit to approach God. the new sacrificial system does. In classical Greek, the word conscience meant to share the knowledge of. The word conscience is two words together. It means with knowledge. Con and science. Science is knowledge. Con is with. So to do with the conscience means you do it with knowledge, or to share the knowledge of something. And so they would go and talk to a judge. They would talk about a judge or an accuser or a witness, something that was testified. And so a man named Philo said that the conscience's role is to accuse us when we've done something wrong and to excuse us when we've done something right. That's kind of the role of the conscience, is that when you do something wrong, your conscience condemns you, so to speak. Your conscience says, you have done wrong. You did that with knowledge. The reason that people feel guilty is because they know something's wrong, and then they do that. So they did it with knowledge. That if you had no idea it was wrong, you don't feel guilty. Hey, you weren't supposed, for instance, when Jonathan ate the honey that day, everybody else heard the command. Jonathan didn't hear the command. Everybody else said, oh, I can't do that. But Jonathan just took the honey and freely ate. And so he didn't sin against his conscience because he didn't have knowledge of the command. When we feel guilty, it's because we know on some level, maybe our conscience is tweaked, maybe it's a little bit misinformed, but we know that there's a right and wrong, and we feel, I just broke that law, and I feel guilty. I did that with knowledge. And the Old Testament sacrificial system could never purge the conscience. But under Jesus, our conscience is purged so that we don't have to live with the guilt of what we had previously done. That can be totally forgiven. It's totally washed away. And because what Jesus did is once for all, it never gets called up again. It never has to haunt us anymore. Our conscience is free. We did all of those things in our past with knowledge, but the guilt of it is now washed away, and our consciences are purged by what Jesus did. And so it's a very different mechanism, very different system than what would happen in the Old Testament. So that's, we didn't really finish with the alternative, what Jesus offered. We got a snapshot and a picture there of what they had in the Old Testament. They did this in this building that they made. They did it with trinkets and things that didn't accomplish anything long term. It was temporary. And instead, and next week we'll start with verse 11 and go on and see the great contrast that Jesus offers. And if someone would ever look at these side by side, you can't, in your right mind, you can't, thinking spiritually, look at these side by side and choose Judaism. You can't choose the old way. You have, if you are thinking clearly, if you're thinking properly, what Jesus gives us is so much better that why should anyone ever go back? So again, this is the all of this argument here in chapters 9 and 10 is the culmination. Jesus is better in this area, but this is a great, the pinnacle reason, because what Jesus did, his sacrifice, we'll talk about next time, the sacrifice that he offered. This week is, some call it Holy Week, this Friday, Good Friday. I hope that you remember as we think about the sacrifice that Jesus did. And we'll celebrate that with Easter, and we'll come back and import that into Hebrews next time. But I hope this week that you take a good look at yourself, a good look at Jesus, and remember what he did for you. And thank him that he's not still on that cross, that he doesn't ever have to go get up on that cross again. It's once and for all. That we don't have to go back. We're not continuously slicing the throats. This is a really, we're in our American Christianity and we read about these things. We don't really fully picture it. It was a turnoff to the Gentiles. When they watched this, they said, this is disgusting. I don't want anything to do with this. It was a very bloody religion. Can you imagine all of the whole nation on this day and other times, they would bring and there's animals killed and blood drained and blood and blood and blood and blood and a reminder of your sin over and over again. And what Jesus did is once and for all. And it's awesome. And may we never stray from it. And so get into the Old Testament. so that you can compare what they had with what you have. If you just see the New Testament, you don't appreciate it as much. You look back in the Old Testament at when they're looking through the lens and it's fuzzy. And now we have clarity. And I pray that this week, with Easter coming up, with celebrating the resurrection, that you rejoice in what Jesus did for you and have a great appreciation for how awful your sin was, first of all, and how awesome His grace is that can overcome your sin. Let's pray together.